The Gospel of John, chapter 2, going through the Gospel of John on Sunday morning. I am loving this book. I did not think that it would be possible for there to be a greater book in the Bible than the book of Matthew. I loved Matthew, but I love the Gospel of John. I am loving this book. And we are in John chapter 2 in verse number 1, a familiar miracle, but let's read it, then we'll come back and go through it. On the third day, there was a marriage in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. And both Jesus was called and his disciples to the marriage. And when they wanted wine, I cannot wait till we talk about that word, the mother of Jesus saith unto him, they have no wine. Jesus saith unto her, woman, what have I to do with thee? Mine hour is not yet come. His mother saith unto the servants, whatsoever he saith unto you, do it. And there were set there 6 water pots of stone, after the manner of the purifying of the Jews, containing 2 or 3 firkins apiece. Jesus saith unto them, fill the water pots with water. And they filled them up to the brim. And he saith unto them, draw out now, and bear unto the governor of the feast, and they bear it. For the ruler of the feast had tasted the water that was made wine, and knew not whence it was, but the servants which drew the water knew. The governor of the feast called the bridegroom, and saith unto him, every man at the beginning doth set forth good wine. And when men have well drunk, then that which is worse. But thou hast kept the good wine unto now. This beginning of miracles did Jesus in Cana of Galilee, and manifested forth his glory, and his disciples believed on him. I think that everybody loves a wedding, because a wedding is supposed to be the most joyous occasion of the human experience. 2 people who have fallen in love commit themselves to one another for the rest of their life. And no one goes into a wedding expecting it to be anything other than a storybook romance. It is going to be filled with days and years of blissful togetherness. And in every culture, this new life together is celebrated by ceremonies and celebrations. And it's just joy all around, from the wedding party to the wedding guests, everybody is just happy. Well, in John chapter 2, we are brought to a wedding that is very quickly turning into a crisis. You see, the traditional wedding feast in this day would normally last as long as 7 days. And the feast has gotten underway, but already the supplies are starting to dwindle. The caterer either did not plan on this many guests, or he did not plan for them to be this thirsty. They're running out of wine, and there is still a whole lot of partying still to be done. And as we will see, this is a serious problem. This could be very embarrassing to the family of the groom. And it's at this wedding that John gives us Jesus' first miracle. The story is told only in the Gospel of John. And it provides a backdrop for Jesus' first demonstration of creative power. Now, it's an interesting story, in that we're not told who the groom is, we're not told who the bride is, or who their families were. We are not told any of the wedding party or any of the guests. We don't know the names of any of them. John does not tell us how Jesus performed this miracle of turning water into wine. Jesus didn't touch the water. Jesus didn't do anything with the water pots. He didn't pronounce any magic words. In fact, he didn't even pray. He just did the miracle. And John begins the chapter with a conjunction, which is unusual. If you notice in John 2 and verse 1, he begins with "and." Well, that's an odd word to begin a brand new chapter. And the word "and" ties us to the events of the previous chapter. Then John says in this first verse that it was the third day. But he doesn't tell us, well, it was the third day from when. So we have to go back to the previous chapter to get our bearings. The last event in chapter 1 was Jesus calling Nathanael to be his disciple. This miracle takes place 3 days after that. It takes place in a nondescript village called Cana. Most Bible dictionaries place that place as about 8 to 9 miles away from Nazareth, which is the childhood home of the Lord Jesus. It may or may not be a coincidence that Jesus calls Nathanael to be his disciple, and Nathanael just happens to be from Cana. It is almost certain that Nathanael had some connection to the home in which this wedding took place. It could have even been home to some of his kinfolks. We don't know. But it could be by the invitation of Nathanael that Jesus and his disciples are guests at this wedding. And the disciples at this point are just the five men that are following him that are called in chapter number one. Mary is there. And the fact that Mary and Jesus are both there indicates that somehow they knew the wedding party. Now when I look at this story, there are some interesting lessons, and I want to break it down into three parts. The first thing I want you to see is, I want you to see that there is a serious situation. The story is very simple, it's very straightforward. In the small village of Canaan, a young couple are getting married. And the ceremony and the celebration is the culmination of an entire year's planning. All of the waiting, all of the preparation, all of the looking at bridal dresses, all of that comes down to this one day. And a bride wants everything to be perfect on that day. But in Middle Eastern cultures, it is the groom that is responsible for the ceremony and the wedding feast that goes on from there. So he is the one that is most concerned that everything goes according to plan. In Jewish customs, a wedding consisted of the groom and his attendants traveling to the home of the bride's father. There would be some kind of ceremony, maybe some speeches or whatever. And then he would take the bride and her bridal party, and there would be a long procession back to his house. Usually that procession was at night, so it was a spectacular torchlight procession. They would come back to the groom's house for the wedding feast. Rabbinic tradition says that if the bride was a virgin, that the wedding normally was on a Wednesday. If the bride was a widow for some reason, the wedding normally was on a Thursday. But they would come back to the groom's house and they would have the wedding feast. And as I said, that wedding feast could last up to 7 days. There is eating, there is drinking, there is partying, they're just having a great time. That's how they did it. And so we come to verse number one. The third day there was a marriage in Cana of Galilee. The mother of Jesus was there, and both Jesus was called and his disciples to the marriage. So at this particular marriage, Mary, the mother of Jesus, is a guest, and she seems to be some kind of coordinator. She is helping out with the refreshments, the arrangements, and she seems to be the one that notices that the wine is running low. These Jewish feasts are lasting a long time, and sometime well into the festivities, somebody in the kitchen notices that the wine is running out. And it's presented as a serious problem. If you were the family of the groom and you were responsible to keep the food and the drinks flowing, then this would be an embarrassing situation if we got three more days and we're out. It would be kind of like if I invited you over for dinner and we ran out of fried chicken before you got a piece. And then we got to go to the kitchen and see if we got any leftover broccoli casserole or whatever we got to warm up. That's kind of what the situation would be. And so when they wanted wine, verse 3, when they wanted wine, the mother of Jesus saith unto him, they have no wine. So Mary seems to assume responsibility. She comes to her son Jesus and she informs him of the situation. She doesn't tell him what to do. In fact, she doesn't tell him to do anything. But there is a request, or at least there's an expectation that is implied in her reply to the Lord Jesus. Why else would she be telling Jesus if she didn't want him to do something about it? Now I will say that I don't believe that she is expecting him to do a miracle. And the reason why, there is no record that he's ever done a miracle before this time, so it's not a miracle that she's expecting, but somehow, maybe Jesus can do something to get us out of this situation. It is also possible, and I do believe this, that Mary probably thought that she was presenting Jesus an opportunity to present himself as the Messiah. You have to bear in mind that Mary never forgot when the angel came to her and said that the child that you're going to bear is going to be the Son of the Most High and is going to sit on the throne. She never forgot that. She never forgot Simeon and Anna testifying when she took him into the temple for purification in 8 days. She never forgot that testimony. She knew that she conceived of him when she was still a virgin. Mary knew that. Mary never forgot the time when he was 12 years old in the temple when he said, "Wist thou not that I must be about my Father's business?" And now, it's become known that John the Baptist has identified her son as the Messiah. And now he has 5 men that are following him. So I don't know what she thought he would do, but there seems to be a hope that maybe he would do something that gets the ball rolling and everybody there would know that he's the Messiah. But look what Jesus says in verse 4. He says, "Woman, what have I to do with thee? Mine hour is not yet come." Now, there's a couple of times in the Bible where Jesus says something that just kind of jolts us just a little bit. When he spoke to that Syrophoenician woman and called her a dog, that just kind of jolts us just a little bit. And when he speaks to his mother and says, "Woman, what have I to do with thee?" And that at first it strikes us as abrupt. Maybe rude, but we don't want to say that, but it seems a little abrupt, it seems a little short. It's not the customary way for a son to address his mother, but I don't believe it's disrespectful. I don't think that Jesus is being disrespectful to his mother, because I know that later at the cross, that Jesus would look down at Mary and would say, "Woman, behold thy son." He's not being disrespectful there. So he is speaking to her and he says, the next statement really is really what explains it when he says, "Woman, what have I to do with thee?" Now that doesn't mean that he doesn't want to have anything to do with her. It's actually a Hebrew idiom. It's a colloquialism. It's an idiom is what it is. It'd be like you and I saying, "What do you and I have in common?" And here's what's happening. Jesus is not rebuking Mary, but he is indicating to Mary that there is a new relationship between him and her as he enters into public ministry. One of the commentators that I read after, he said that Mary could no longer view him as other mothers viewed their sons. She is no longer allowed the prerogatives of motherhood. And isn't it a remarkable thing that everywhere that Mary appears in the course of the Lord Jesus' ministry, that Jesus goes to make a distance from her and from his earthly family. In fact, come back to Matthew chapter 12. Hold your finger here. Go to Matthew chapter 12 and I'll show you that in an example. Matthew chapter number 12 and look at verse number 46. Matthew chapter 12 and verse 46. "While he yet talked to the people, behold, his mother and his brethren stood without, desiring to speak with him. Then one said unto him, Behold, thy mother and thy brethren stand without, desiring to speak with thee. But he answered and said unto them that told him, Who is my mother and who are my brethren? And he stretched forth his hand toward his disciples and said, Behold my mother and my brethren, for whosoever shall do the will of my Father, which is in heaven, the same is my brother and sister and mother." Jesus loved his mother. On the cross, he makes sure that she is going to be taken care of after he dies. And he asked John to assume his position as her son. But here's the thing about it. Mary was a sinner. And Mary needed him as the Son of God more than she needed him as the son of Mary. And at the very outset of his ministry, this gives him an opportunity to illustrate that there is a new relationship moving forward. Well, here's what's so interesting to me about this. The Roman Catholic Church worships Mary. And they believe that you can pray to Mary and that she will talk to Jesus for you. And if you go through Mary, you'll always get your request because a son can't deny his mother and that Jesus would never say no to Mary. Now, that's what the Catholic Church teaches. By the way, they get that from John chapter 2. Now watch this. The Catholic interpretation of John chapter 2 is that Mary used her motherly influence over him to get him to perform this miracle. This is one of their proof texts for getting to Jesus through Mary. Well, that seems strange to me because basically Jesus tells her that you can't tell me what to do. If anything, the passage tells us that in his ministry that Mary had no influence over him. It's the only time in the Gospels that Mary ever made any request to Jesus. And he basically responded by saying, my business is different than what you think it ought to be. We'll come back to John chapter 2, look if you would, in verse number 5. His mother saith unto the servants, whatsoever he saith unto you, do it. Well, that's a remarkable response if she feels like that she has just been slighted or rebuked by her son. She doesn't seem put off by his words. She doesn't argue with him. She simply puts the situation in his hands. He may not tell the servants to do anything. She doesn't know. But if he does whatever he tells you, just do it. By the way, that's good advice for any situation, isn't it? Whatever he tells you to do in his word, just do it. Just do it. Well, in verse number 6, here's the miracle. There were set there yet 6 water pots of stone, after the manner of the purifying of the Jews, containing 2 or 3 firkins apiece. Jesus said unto them, fill the water pots with water, and they filled them up to the brim. And he saith unto them, draw out now, and bear them to the governor of the feast, and they bear it. Now here's the phrase that I want you to notice in verse number 6. There were set there 6 water pots of stone, here's the phrase, after the manner of the purifying of the Jews. Nothing was more important to Jews than rites of purification. They had taken the ceremonial laws of cleanliness in the books of Moses, and they had turned them into volumes, a massive code of rituals that all had to do with external cleansing. The mission is the oral tradition of the rabbi's teaching, and in the last book of the Mishnah, there are 26 chapters that have to do with ceremonial washing and ceremonial cleaning, and it's all external. And if you go to Mark chapter 7, verse 6, 7, and 8, these Jewish people, they are fastidious about external cleansing while their heart is far away from God. So it is that at the wedding of Cana, there are 6 large water pots of water that are there just for the guests to use in their washing their hands and washing their feet and whatever else they had to do to stay ceremonially clean. This is not drinking water. This is water that they are using for their purification rites. Most commentators have said that these water pots with these firkins, that you're looking at about 150 gallons of water. Not drinking water. Water you wash your hands in. Well, the miracle is very simple. Jesus tells the servants to fill these water pots all the way to the top with water, and then out of that, take your smaller vessels, like your pitchers, and you draw water from that, and you give it to the governor of the feast. It's not water that you would drink. It's water that you use for washing your hands or whatever it might be. Jesus does not transform the water into wine and then tell them to take it. No, he doesn't tell them what he's going to do. He simply says, take this water, go give it to the governor of the feast. And they're going to take it. This is the test. You take it and you give it to the governor as if it is good to drink. Now, no one could have possibly imagined what was going to happen. Jesus didn't speak any words. He didn't do any hocus pocus. He didn't have any antics. He didn't touch the water. He didn't touch the water pots. But somewhere between them dipping their pitchers into that water and them giving it to the governor, somewhere in the white space between verse 7 and verse number 8, there is a transformation that takes place. Somewhere between those two verses, water becomes wine. Wine comes from the vine. A seed grows a vine, and a vine grows a grape, and grapes are turned into a drink, and the process requires soil, and it requires sunshine, and it requires nutrients, and it requires water, and Jesus bypassed all of that, and he made water become wine with none of the natural processes. That's a miracle. Well, look if you would in verse number 9. When the ruler of the feast had tasted the water that was made wine, and knew not whence it was, but the servants which drew the water knew, the governor of the feast called the bridegroom and said unto him, every man at the beginning doth set forth good wine, and when men have well drunk, then that which is worse, but thou hast kept the good wine until now. And this would be a great place for me to just stop and answer the question that's on everybody's mind. Did Jesus create fermented wine? Was this wine alcoholic? And if it was, does it give me justification to have a little wine with my meal, a little social drinking? You'd be surprised that even in church like this, you might have somebody that thinks it's okay to have a little wine or a little alcoholic beverage, as long as it is in moderation. Can I take just a few minutes and preach for just a minute? Alcohol is one of the deadliest curses in our land. It is America's favorite drug because it is estimated that 71% of Americans 18 years or older have drank alcohol to some extent. You can get it at the grocery store, you can get it at the bar, you can get it at the ballpark, you can get it at the convenience store. In fact, if it were not for lottery tickets, cigarettes, and beer, 95% of convenience stores would go out of business. You go to a restaurant, they want to sell you a glass of wine. You sit down on an airplane, they want to sell you a little bottle of vodka. You go to a ballpark, somebody's hawking beer to all the drunks that are sitting around you. You go to a company Christmas party, and it is flowing with liquor. And there's no stigma in America against liquor. One of the biggest farces, I think, in our judicial system was all the class action lawsuits against tobacco, but none against alcohol. Well, alcohol kills as many people as cigarettes, so why not sue them too? It's because it's a bunch of drunks that are voting on it. You can go to the restaurant and somebody smoke and everybody complains, but somebody drinks and nobody complains. Years ago, the government had a $50,000 grant they gave to somebody to study the causes of alcoholism. And they spent $50,000 on the study and they concluded that they did not know what causes alcoholism. I can tell you for 50 cents. Alcohol causes alcoholism. Yeah. Now here's what you need to know. The word wine in the Bible doesn't always refer to fermented wine or intoxicating drink. Sometimes the word is wine is condemned. Sometimes it is commended. Sometimes it's just commented on. And that has opened the door for people to think, all right, maybe it's okay to use it in moderation. Look, if you would, in Proverbs chapter 23. Proverbs chapter 23, and I'll just give you a couple of verses here. But look at Proverbs chapter 23, and it's going to give you a clue. Proverbs 23 and verse number 31. Proverbs 23 and verse 31, look not thou upon the wine when it is red, when it giveth his color in the cup, when it moveth itself. Do you see the key word? What it is describing is the process of fermentation. This is fermented wine. This word when, look not upon the wine when it is doing this. It is okay until it is doing this. When it moves into the fermentation stage, then leave it alone. And what confuses people is that the word, it's a generic word. And so here's what you have to do. You have to look at the context in the Bible to know what it's talking about. For example, Isaiah 65 and verse 8, thus saith the Lord, as the new wine is found in the cluster. That's a grape before it is even squeezed. In the cluster, it is called new wine. There is no way that is interpreted as fermented wine because it does not ferment while it is on the vine. You can drink as much grape juice as you want to, and you're not going to get drunk. So the word is interpreted in light of the context. For example, and I've given this illustration before, but if I ask you, would you like to go now out tonight after the service and have a drink? Am I asking you for alcohol or non-alcoholic? Well, it depends. Who's asking? Where are we going? Who are we going with? Because a drink could mean beer or it could mean a Diet Coke. But every time somebody's ever asked you that, you knew exactly what they were talking about. If I say, hey, let's go to McDonald's. We're not going to McDonald's, but if I was to say, let's go to McDonald's and have a drink, then we're probably having a Coca-Cola. Right? But if I say, hey, let's get some buddies and let's go to Ollie's Bar and Grill after work and have some drinks, that's a different picture, isn't it? The same word is used, but you have to look at the context. That's how you do it in the Bible. So, Proverbs 20 and verse 1, wine is a mocker, strong drink is raging, and whosoever is deceived thereby is not wise. Has grape juice ever mocked somebody? Has grape juice ever made a fool out of somebody? Has grape juice ever been raging? No. The context is clearly intoxicating. It will mock you. It will rage inside you. And you're not wise if you take it. Proverbs 23, we're right here. Proverbs 23, look at verse number 29. Verse 29. Who hath woe? Who hath sorrow? Who hath contentions? Who hath babbling? Who hath wounds without cause? Who hath redness of eyes? I'll tell you who. They that tarry long at the wine. They that go to seek mixed wine. Look not thou upon the wine when it's red, when it giveth its color in the cup, when it moveth itself upright. At the last it biteth like a serpent and stingeth like an adder. Thine eyes shall behold strange women in thy heart. So utter preserved first things. Yea, thou shalt be as he that lieth down in the midst of the sea, or as he that lieth upon the top of the mast. Well, is he talking about fermented or unfermented? Well, does grape juice cause woe and sorrow? No. Does grape juice make you contentious and babbling? No. Does grape juice give you redness of eyes? No. So it's very clear what he's talking about. Habakkuk 2 and verse 5. Yea, also because he transgresseth by wine. You don't transgress by unfermented wine. Fermented wine doesn't make you proud and arrogant. I'm enjoying this. I hope you are. Habakkuk 2:15. Oh, here's a good one. Habakkuk 2:15. Woe unto him that giveth his neighbor drink, that putteth thy bottle to him, and maketh him drunken also, that thou mayest look on their nakedness. Do you know the Bible teaches it's not only a sin to drink, it's a sin to give drink to somebody else. Woe to him that gives his neighbor to drink. You know, old time preachers used to preach years ago that a Christian should not work where they sell alcohol. And they were right. Can you imagine a Christian working at the ABC package store? Huh? I mean, if I had to take a side job and you found me down at the ABC package store, you wouldn't want to see that, would you? Huh? In fact, you wouldn't want to see me working at a convenience store where they sell as much alcohol as they do at the package store. Right. If you work at a restaurant and I walked in and saw a church member walking by with a tray full of beer and alcohol headed, you'd be embarrassed, and you ought to be. Huh? How about if I walked in a convenience store and you're selling some bum a six-pack of beer so he can go out and get drunk? Woe to him that putteth his bottle to his neighbor's lips. So the question is, did Jesus drink fermented wine at the wedding of Cana? There is no argument. Jesus never created anything that was rotten, that was fermented, that was poisonous, that was intoxicating. Woe unto him that giveth his neighbor to drink. Don't you think that Jesus was aware of that verse? Do you think that Jesus would use his creative powers to provide intoxicating wine? Don't you think it would be a little bit inconsistent with his character to give men something to drink which causes woe, which causes you to be sick, which leads men into adultery? That doesn't sound like Jesus. Here's what Jesus did. He did the same thing in that pot that happens on the vine. He turned water into grape juice, which is what the vine does. It draws water from the ground and it converts it into juice. And the wine never converts, the vine never converts water into alcohol. And Jesus did in an instant what it takes the vine months to do. That's what happened. In fact, he says in John 2, come back to it. Enjoyed that little rant. John 2 and verse 11, this beginning of miracles did Jesus at Cana of Galilee and manifested forth his glory. How would have creating fermented wine manifested his glory? Could God's glory be manifest by men becoming intoxicated by what he created? Would a drunken feast have manifested his glory? And some people jump on verse number 10 when it says, when men have well drunk, to prove that they got drunk off the wine Jesus made. All you have to do is just read the Bible. The text says, when men, it doesn't say when they are well drunk. It says when they have well drunk. It means they've drunk all that they wanted to. Now, it is not that they're drunk. They just had plenty to drink. Serious situation. But I want you to notice, secondly, there is a supernatural sign. In John chapter 20, John summarizes his gospel and he says, many other signs truly did Jesus in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. In the gospel of John, there are seven miracles that are recorded and John calls them signs. Now elsewhere in the gospel, he uses the word miracle throughout the book. And nearly every modern translation will take that word miracle and change it to sign throughout the book. And there's absolutely no need to do that. John tells you that there are signs, and that's enough. Jesus never performed a miracle as a naked display of power. He never conjured up tricks for the masses. That's not the purpose for it. The miracles that he performed, especially the ones recorded in John, are a sign of something beyond the miracle. The miracles are a vehicle to point to a deeper truth, a different reality. One writer said that the miracles are like parables in that it's designed to teach you something beyond the parable, beyond the miracle. And while the lesson in a lot of the miracles are obvious, some are not so. For example, in John chapter 6, Jesus feeds the 5,000. Right after that, he says, I am the bread of life. In John chapter 8, Jesus says that I am the light of the world. In the very next chapter, he heals a man born blind. In John chapter 11, he stands at the tomb of Lazarus and says, I am the resurrection and the life, and proves it by calling Lazarus from the grave. But in this miracle, there is no such definitive statement except for the last statement, where it says, the beginning of miracles did Jesus in Cana of Galilee and manifested forth his glory. This miracle is a display of his glory. Now, that's interesting to me. Because the way in which he did the miracle was almost anonymously. If you will notice that the story doesn't tell us anything that Jesus did. We know it was his power that transformed the water into wine. He's the only one that could do that. And he could have called everybody's attention. Everybody gather around. Everybody get close. I want to see what he get ready to do. He could have done that. But I think that most people there didn't even know what had happened. The servants knew, but they didn't know how. Yet to his disciples, what they witnessed was the first display of his glory and his power. And isn't it interesting how that a guest became the most important person at the wedding? Have you ever been to a wedding and nobody knew who the bride was? You ever been to a wedding and nobody knew the name of the groom? Does anybody know the maid of honor? Where's the best man at? Mary is there, but she's only there because she came to Jesus for help. The most important person at the wedding was Jesus. By the way, I would say this, he'll be the most important wedding person at your wedding too. In your career, in your home, in your life, everywhere. Huh? Can you imagine the shame and the disappointment that this young couple's wedding, if Jesus had not been there, and that would be the end of your home and your life without Jesus too. So how does this miracle show a sign of His glory? In John chapter 1, John introduces Jesus as creator of the universe. In the beginning was the Word. The Word was with God. The Word was God. The same was in the beginning with God. All things made by Him, and without Him, not anything made that was made. He's the creator. Now in John chapter 2, John chooses to give as his first miracle, a miracle of creation. It's as if he's saying, I told you he was the creator, but I'm going to tell you about a time that I saw it with my very own eyes. His glory is revealed in greater measure on the cross and in the resurrection and His exaltation. But every step along the way, there were glimpses of the glory of Christ. The servants saw the sign, but they didn't see the glory. The disciples saw the glory, and they believed on Him. It's a sign of His glory. But then I want you to notice that there is a spiritual significance. Because when we bring this miracle into our life, what does it mean to us? And there is a lesson in this miracle for unbelieving Israel. And I believe there's a lesson for you and I. In the Bible, wine is a symbol of joy, especially in the Messianic kingdom. Psalm 104, verse number 14. He causes the grass to grow for the cattle, and herb for the service of man, that he may bring forth food out of the earth, and wine that maketh glad the heart of man. Wine meant abundance. Wine meant satisfaction, fullness. It meant joy. It is a symbol of God's provision, of God's bountiful blessing, especially during the millennium. Over and over and over, the prophet said that he would make Israel to flourish and their vineyards would burst forth with new wine. Now, I want you to set that in the context of the spiritual state of the nation of Israel. Judaism has all the ceremonies. They have all the rituals of religion. What they have is they have water pots of ceremonial washings. But they had no joy. They had no fulfillment. They had no wine. The statement they have no wine is the spiritual state of Israel. One of the prevailing themes of the Gospel of John that we'll see over and over and over is the failure of Judaism. You already saw it in chapter 1. He came unto his own, and his own received him not. For all of their rabbis, and for all of their teachings, and for all of their traditions, and for all of their rituals, they didn't recognize Jesus when he showed up. For all of their study of the Old Testament, they still didn't recognize him when he came. What good is religion and rites and rituals and ceremonies and church services if you don't see Jesus in that? In John chapter 1, priests and Levites come from Jerusalem to question John about Christ. And here's John's answer. John's answer is, there standeth one among you whom ye know not. That's Judaism. Judaism was dead. There is no life. There is no power. There is no joy. There is no wine. And what it needs to happen is it needs to be set aside for a new hope. And in the miracle, there is water in the water pots, but there is no wine. And all that the guests could do is go through another ceremonial washing, go through another ritual, go through another rite of purification, but they're not going to enjoy the marriage feast. All Judaism could do is tell you, perform another ceremony, do another washing, do another thing, but there's no joy in none of that. Do you know what Jesus did? He took a burdensome thing and he made it a joyous thing. Jesus said that all of the regulations and all the requirements of the Pharisees, he says it is burdensome. He said they bind heavy burdens and grievous to be borne and lay them on men's shoulders. The Old Testament law requires washing, but over the years they've added so many rituals and so many rules and so many restrictions to it. And Jesus said that all of this ceremonial washing, it is a burden to everyone. And he takes what is a burden to them and he turns it into a source of great joy. Do you know what you will find in Jesus? You will find that he can take a life that is filled with pain and drudgery and unfulfillment and a life of sin, and he can transform it into a life of hope and joy and fulfillment and satisfaction. He can take that which hath no life in it and he can make the best wine out of it. That's what Jesus can do. In fact, here's what the steward said. He said, thou hast kept the good wine until now. See, normally you serve the best first. But when you come to the house for dinner, we're not pulling the cheap stuff out first. No, we're going to start with the good stuff, the good stuff. And if we start to run out, then we may have to go, you know, get the pork chops in the refrigerator. We might have to, you know, find it. If you keep eating, then we're going to have to, it's going to decrease in value and taste the more that you eat. But we're going to start with the ribeye. We're going to start with the good stuff is what we're going to do. And they tasted what Jesus provided. And here's what they said. They said, this is better than what we had before. You thought you had the good life, but then you got saved. And you discovered that this is better than that. By the way, one day we're all going to get to heaven. And we're going to look back on the life that He gave us. And we're going to say, thou hast kept the good wine until now. The wine had run out. There's no way to get another supply. There's no way to save this groom from embarrassment. Judaism has done nothing for Israel except put a burden on them. And the life of sin does nothing except burden you. But when Mary came to Jesus and essentially said, we have a problem. And you are the only hope that we have. That is where Jesus stepped in and performed a miracle. Because Jesus specializes in providing where there is no other provision. Jesus specializes in giving what nobody else is able to give. When you reach the end of all of your resources, and you come to Him and say, I turn to you, because I don't have anybody else to turn to. That's when Jesus can take the water pots and turn it into wine. Do you have the joy that salvation brings? If not, then you need to come to Christ. You could have religion just like Israel. No joy. No satisfaction. No peace in your heart. Just get another ceremonial washing. Perform another ritual. Do another little service. It's not going to help. All it is water pots. That's all it is. But when you come to Jesus, you say, there is no joy in my water pot. I need what only you can give. Jesus can perform that miracle and create that new life in you. Our piano player is coming. Here's what blesses me about this miracle. It is a non-essential miracle. Here's what I mean. If somebody is blind, that's an essential need. If somebody's dead, raising somebody, that's an essential need. But this miracle, if Jesus doesn't perform it, the wedding goes on. The guests will be embarrassed, but they'll still be married. And in a couple of days, they'll get over it, and they'll be okay. Really, when you look at it that way, this is the least important miracle that Jesus ever performed. And here's what it tells me. Jesus is not interested in just the big, drastic needs. Jesus is there to give you joy in all of your life. Jesus cares for the little things. He cares for you in ways that most people wouldn't care. You don't have a need. You don't have a care that is too small to bring to Him. Why bother Jesus with this problem? I'll tell you why. Because He cares.